All right, our scripture reading today is from Mark 15, 1 through 39, and that's on page 852. And as soon as it was morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council. And they bound Jesus and led him away and delivered him over to Pilate. And Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him, "You have said so." And the chief priests accused him of many things, and Pilate asked him again, "Have you no answer to make? See how many charges they bring against you." But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate was amazed. Now at the feast he used to release for them one prisoner for whom they asked. And among the rebels in prison who had committed murder in the insurrection, there was a man called Barabbas. And the crowd came up and began to ask Pilate to do as he usually did for them. And he answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" For he perceived that it was out of envy that the chief priests had delivered him up. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have him release for them Barabbas instead. And Pilate again said to them, "Then what shall I do with the man you call the king of the Jews?" And they cried out again, "Crucify him." And Pilate said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him." So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released for them Barabbas. And having scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. And the soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is, the governor's headquarters. And they called together the whole battalion. And they clothed him in a purple cloak, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they were striking his head with a reed, and spitting on him, and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of his purple cloak and put his own clothes on him. And they led him out to crucify him. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. And they brought him to the palace called Golgotha, which means place of the skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them, to decide which each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him, and the insurrection of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads, and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others, but he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani?" Which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of the bystanders hearing it said, "Behold, he is calling Elijah." And then someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down." And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who was facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God."
We sang some important lyrics. "I will rise and go to Jesus. In him are 10,000 charms. Curtain torn in two, the dead are raised to life. Finished the victory cry. See him in the new Jerusalem." All of these lyrics getting at the same thing, that we will draw near to God. My first few months of college were similar to Jessica's. I was lonely. I got there having left a good youth group, a good family, really close friend group at my school. Got to college and I didn't have a community. I was lonely. Worst of all, I moved to California. Secretly, I did love it there. One weekend, my RA was on his way out of the dorm. He was a senior. He had his community established. He had his good friend groups, but he popped in my room on his way out of the dorm and he said, "Hey man, I'm going to my parents' beach house with some friends this weekend. Do you want to come with me?" I obviously had nothing else going on, so I went with him. I was nervous. I had my bag packed, walking to the car. I saw the guys I was going with, all older guys, and I was this insecure, lonely, scared freshman. But when I got to the car, as I was loading my bags into the car, my RA, Micah, he said, "Hey guys, have you met Connor? He's on my wing. He's cool." And in an instant, I went from this lonely and scared freshman to being one of the guys. He put himself on the line, his social status, his community, to bring me in. And that's the same thing that Jesus does in Mark 15. Jesus' death provides access to God's presence. But to get to that point, Mark first lays the groundwork of substitution. Jesus puts himself in our place. He takes the full brunt of our sin in some specific ways. He takes our death, our shame, and our rejection so that we might enter freely into the presence of God. So we've got a simple outline this morning, 2 points. First, Jesus is your saving substitute in verses 1 through 37. Second, Jesus is your divine access in verses 38 and 39. If you feel like a hypocrite, like you are too sinful for God to ever save you, this passage shows you there is no such thing. If you're new to church and maybe you've heard phrases like salvation or redemption, and you just want to know, what does that even mean? Well, this passage will clarify that for you. And if you think that Christianity is just dogma, just a set of beliefs that we use to alienate people, this passage shows you Christianity is so much more than that. It changes the most basic things about who we are. It changes our relationships, our community. We need Christianity desperately, and we need this central message of Christianity, the cross of Christ. So let's hop in. Story begins with Jesus' trial before Pilate. In verse 3, he's accused of many things, but only one accusation sticks. That's in verse 2. Let's read that. Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered, "You have said so." To Pilate, it doesn't matter everything else that they were claiming about Jesus, that he was guilty of blasphemy for claiming to be the son of the blessed or the son of man. That didn't matter. Romans had many gods. What's one more? What mattered to Pilate is that he's accused of being the king of the Jews, an opposing threat to Pilate. And yet, read verse 5. Jesus made no further answer so that Pilate was amazed. To Pilate, Jesus is not a threat. He doesn't feel threatened. This man is a poor peasant. He's a traveling preacher. There's no threat there. And in fact, Pilate hits the nail on the head in verse 14. Pilate said to them, "Why, what evil has he done?" He sees that this man is innocent. So we've got this pair of concepts, his innocence and his silence in the face of accusation. These two things scream of Isaiah chapter 53. Isaiah had promised that a substitute would come and stand in the place of the people, that he would bear the transgressions of the people so that they don't have to. He would take the penalty of sin so that other people can be free from that penalty. But Isaiah 53 pinpoints who is that substitute. Isaiah 53:7 says, "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to its slaughter, like a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth." So in his silence, Jesus speaks to us. He says, "I am the substitute for many. What I'm about to endure means that other people don't have to." When I worked at summer camp, I was in charge of planning nightly activities for the boys' staff. One night, it was raining really hard. Our other plan got canceled, but we saw an opportunity. We had a game that was played in this enclosed wooden fence on a pile of dirt. And with the rain coming down, we thought that would be a ton of fun in a pool of mud. So we played, and it was. As you can imagine, there was mud everywhere, the whole fence covered in mud. My boss's first words to me at prayer meeting the next morning, it's like 7:28 a.m., I'm not even awake yet. He comes up to me and he says, "What have you done? That fence looks like a pigsty. You have to clean it." The penalty was clear. I needed to clean that, but I already had plans. I had to take a group of campers to go canoeing that morning on this beautiful, serene lake. So a friend of mine stood in my place, literally had to stand there for like 3 hours alone with a pressure washer, just washing the mud off the fence. That's substitution. He took the penalty so that I got off scot-free. That's what Jesus does in this passage. That's what verses 1-5 lay the groundwork. Jesus is our substitute, but what is he substituting for us? What does he take in our place? First, death in verses 6-15. Second, shame in verses 16-20. Third, rejection from men in verses 21-32. Fourth, rejection from God in verses 33-37. In verses 6-15, Pilate has two prisoners who are on the chopping block. One of these men is going to die. The other one is going to be released to appease the Jews. One is Jesus, obviously, but then the second one is introduced in verse 7, Barabbas, a murderer. His name means son of the father, and think about the symbolism in that name. We've got Barabbas, son of the father, Jesus, son of God. Barabbas, guilty of murder, Jesus, the giver of life. Barabbas, deserving of death, Jesus, innocent. Barabbas, an insignificant crook, Jesus, the king of the Jews. Says that two more times. Look down at verses 9 and verse 12. Jesus, the king of the Jews. Mark is driving this point home. The story comes to a climax then in verse 15. A decision has to be made. Let's read that. Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released for them Barabbas. And having scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. Jesus is killed. And Barabbas, a guilty man, is set free, son of the father. Does this sound familiar to you? We are Barabbas in the story of the Bible. We are guilty, but this is good news. Jesus has taken our place in death so that we are free to live as sons of the father. Not only that, our saving substitute took our shame in verses 16-20. Jesus is brought into the governor's headquarters to be mocked and scorned. Let's read verse 17. They clothed him in a purple cloak and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him and they began to salute him. Hail, King of the Jews. The mockery is obvious. You can imagine the scene. There's a whole battalion of soldiers, 600 men, armed, strong men. They've got their shields and their weapons and they're beating up on this poor, lonely peasant. The movie Radio is the story of James Robert Kennedy. He's a mentally disabled black man living shortly after segregation. He goes to this new school. He's befriended by the school's football coach and becomes his personal assistant. But halfway through the movie, there's this heartbreaking scene. The seniors on the football team, the strong men, bind him up. They tie his feet and his hands together. They put a blindfold over him and they lock him in a tin shed. And they start beating the side of the shed with their pads and the footballs. And when the coach finally sees what's happening and comes to his rescue, Radio is sitting in the corner of the shed crying, afraid for his life. It's despicable. He is robbed of all of his dignity. And that's the scene that Jesus puts himself into on our behalf. Jesus is robbed of his humanity, his dignity. His reputation is reduced to nothing. His status is nothing. It's total humiliation. Look further, it gets even worse. Look in verse 24. They crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. In case that didn't translate for you, Jesus, the sinless and pure man, hung naked on a cross for all to see. Total humiliation. Verse 20 actually sums up the whole point really well. When they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his own clothes on him. The king of the Jews is brought low. We've had our fun pretending. We've had our fun saluting him, king of the Jews. But now it's time for the whole world to know he is nothing but a poor, worthless peasant. Now consider this. This shame is not just a fringe detail on the way to Jesus' death. This shame is actually a key part of what Jesus is substituting himself for you. The King of the Jews receives the crown of thorns so that we might receive the crown of life. The Son of God is stripped naked so that we might be clothed in righteousness. Jesus is humiliated so that we might be glorified and considered honorable vessels before God. Think about this in terms of your own life. The things that you have done that have damaged your reputation, the things that you would do anything to take back, that if the other people around you only knew, they would be disgusted. Those things don't define you. That is not who you are at your core. Your shame is dumped on Jesus at the cross so that you can be made clean. Jesus substituted himself for you in death, in shame. Third, your substitute is rejected by men. The first 3 hours on the cross emphasize this point in verses 21 through 32. Jesus has no friends left to help him carry the cross. They have to rope in Simon of Cyrene, this man who's a Gentile. He's the best they could get. In verse 29, he's insulted by random people passing by. In verse 31, he's mocked by the religious leaders, his own peers. But central to his rejection by men is verse 26. The inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." Consider the fact that just 5 days prior, Jesus was heralded, welcomed into the city. Mark 11, verse 10, "Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David." He's welcomed in his right relationship with men. He is their king, their high king, the King of the Jews. And look at his title throughout this whole story. I've already mentioned it a few times. Verse 2, Pilate asked him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Verse 9, "Do you want me to release for you the King of the Jews?" Verse 12, "Then what shall I do with the man you call the King of the Jews?" Verse 18, "Hail, King of the Jews." Verse 26, "The inscription of the charge against him read, 'The King of the Jews.'" Verse 32, "Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down." Jesus is almost exclusively called the King of the Jews, and yet it's all a farce. The rejection that occurs is not just abandonment, it's not just insult, it's a denial of who he is at his core, their king. In fact, this is Jesus's role on earth. Mark 1:16, Jesus gives his purpose statement, the very beginning of his ministry. "This is what I'm doing. The time is fulfilled. The kingdom of God is at hand." This is who Jesus is. This is why he's here. And he is rejected. They deny his kingdom, and yet Jesus' rejection is not ultimately from men. Earlier, I talked about Isaiah 53. Jesus is our saving substitute. We could see that throughout the chapter. He's numbered among the transgressors as he's hung between criminals. He's despised and rejected by men. In so many ways, he fulfills Isaiah 53. But what that means is that Isaiah 53:4 is true. He was smitten by God. Isaiah 53:10, "It was the will of the Lord to crush him." This is the emphasis of verses 33 through 39. The cross is torturous, but it doesn't reach its full agony until Jesus is rejected by the Father. Verse 33, "When the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour." Darkness is physically uncomfortable. You can imagine with open wounds, with blood streaming down your body, the darkness is cold, it's agonizingly painful, but the significance runs far deeper than this physical pain. This is the fulfillment of Amos chapter 8, this darkness. Amos 8, verse 9 and 10, it says, "On that day, declares the Lord, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight." That's exactly what's happening here. Amos 8, verse 10, "I will turn your feasts into mourning. I will make it like the mourning for an only son." The darkness helps us to realize what's really going on here. A son is dying. It's even more tragic when you consider the relationship that this son has with his father. We've seen three conversations between Jesus and God the Father throughout the Gospel of Mark. The first is at Jesus' baptism. And what does God say? This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. Second is that Jesus' transfiguration. The Father declares, this is my beloved son. Listen to him. The third is in the Garden of Gethsemane. And even then, Jesus cries, Abba, Father. You can see that the intimacy in their relationship, beloved son, Abba, Father. In fact, the Son of God is Jesus' core identity in Mark's gospel. Mark 1:1, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. This is who he is at his core. And yet the relationship has shifted. As he hangs in darkness on the cross, he doesn't even cry out to Father. Read verse 34. At the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? All the intimacy of the Father-Son relationship, it's gone. Jesus is quoting Psalm 22, where it continues, oh my God, I cry by day, but you don't answer. By night, but I find no rest. In his greatest moment of need, there is nobody there. The relationship is severed. Jesus dies naked and alone. How great the pain of searing loss, the Father turns his face away. Every morning when my two-year-old son wakes up, he cries out for his mom or his dad to come get him. We enter his room and we hold him. We ask him what he wants for breakfast. The relationship is reliable. It's consistent. We're concerned for his well-being. But imagine one morning he cries out and nobody answers. He's stuck in his crib alone. The house gets colder as snow falls outside, but nobody comes. Hours pass and he realizes nobody's going to come. He dies in agony, abandoned and devastated. This is the tragedy of the Son of God dead on the cross. But there's one key difference in the story of Jesus, because unlike a toddler who is helpless, he has no say in the matter, Jesus chose this for you. Jesus did this for you, the emotional burden, the tragedy of the heartache, the tear in the relationship with his Father. This is substitutionary. This is for your benefit. This means that when you come to God, as the author of Hebrews says, you come in confidence that you might find mercy and grace in your time of need, all because Jesus found none. Jesus is rejected by the Father that you might be accepted. The next verse is perplexing, but it actually helps us realize the significance of this whole account of the crucifixion in the context of chapter 15. Let's read verses 35 and 36. Some of the bystanders hearing it said, behold, he is calling Elijah. And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave it to him to drink, saying, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down. Now, this doesn't make any sense at all unless you understand their frame of thought. The Jews were thinking back to Malachi chapter 4, verse 5, where it says that before the great and awesome day of the Lord, Elijah would come. Now, Elijah already came, right? It was John the Baptist, and they missed that. They were confused about that. But these people actually hit the nail on the head. They are spot on. The day of the Lord is happening here. Everything described in Malachi 3 and 4, it's happening right now. Mark includes their somewhat misguided comment to draw our attention to this. What happens on the day of the Lord in Malachi 3 and 4? Well, three specific things. God establishes his kingdom over the earth. Second, God's presence enters his temple. And third, God makes a people into his treasured possession like sons to him. Mark includes this reference to clue us in. This is what Jesus is fulfilling. God's rule, God's presence, God's people, it's all happening right here on the cross. How? Verse 37. Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. Mission accomplished. Kingdom established. Everything that the people were waiting for, this great and awesome day of the Lord, it's here, but it is not at all as the people expected it. Jesus' death establishes his kingdom by bringing us into God's presence. Look at the next two verses. Verse 38, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The temple is where God's glory dwelled with Israel, right? We have the description in 2 Chronicles 7 of the glory cloud descending down into the temple and all of the people of Israel falling with their face to the pavement in reverence to this glory. But when the temple was destroyed in 586 and when it was rebuilt, God's glory cloud never re-entered the temple. This temple that was alive and present in Jesus' day, it didn't have that glory cloud descending into it. And so the people are waiting for that to happen again. They're anticipating God returning to his temple, like it says in Malachi chapter 3. Now, finally, as Jesus dies, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. God's glory is made available to man again, but it's not at all in the way they expect it. To help pinpoint, to clarify, get a little more precision as to how is God's glory made available to us, there's one key word in this verse. It's that word torn. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. This word is only used one other time in Mark's gospel. It's in Mark chapter 1, verse 9. I already referenced it once. It's the baptism of Jesus. As Jesus is baptized, he's brought back up out of the water, and immediately the heavens are torn open. The voice of God the Father comes down and says, "This is my beloved Son," and the Spirit of God descends into Jesus. It's this moment of Trinitarian intimacy. That's the access that Jesus gives you to God's glory. Intimate relationship, perfect relationship, beloved by the Father. Some of you have probably watched videos, some of you have lived this firsthand, of a young man returning from war. He's still wearing his military uniform. He gets off the plane and his father embraces him. And there's tears. The father is crying because my son is home. He's safe. He's in my arms again. That's what Jesus brings you into. That's the access that Jesus provides you as he dies in your place. That is the king's mission accomplished upon the king's cross, the kingdom of God established. Think of what this means in the context of this whole chapter. God's kingdom has a better ruler than Pilate, has a greater power than the soldiers, it has a better people than the people who are hurling insults at Jesus, it has better access to God than the chief priests and the scribes can offer. In other words, when Jesus dies on the cross, everyone opposing Jesus' rule on earth is put to shame. This is the victory of the king. If we believe in this, if we believe in this kingdom, that makes us a people who are not reliant upon politics. We're not reliant upon social change, social improvement. We're not reliant upon some newfound religion, some betterment of the human race. We are reliant fully upon Jesus to accomplish everything our society needs. Think about what this means for your relationships. We are a people who are defined by the fact that we don't belong in God's presence, and yet he shows us mercy and grace and acceptance. He draws us in. That's who we are at our core. So when someone else wrongs us, when someone offends us, and they don't deserve our forgiveness, our grace, we offer it anyway. That's who we are. This redefines our relationships. I got to be on the receiving end of this in a conversation this last week. I had wronged someone. I didn't deserve forgiveness, and yet I received it anyway, because this is a gospel-empowered relationship. This is liberating. This changes who we are as a community. A group of people who offers grace instead of canceling each other, who's willing to bear with one another instead of immediately throwing insults and writing people off. This is what our world needs. The cross of Christ is not just dogma. This is not just a creed. This is something that changes who we are at our very core. The world is desperate for this truth. Look in verse 39. When the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." By bringing us in, Jesus shows that he is so much more than just the King of the Jews, no mere human could accomplish what Jesus has just accomplished. This is the identity that Mark has set out to establish from the very beginning of the book, the Son of God. And finally, someone understands it. This is the first human in the entire book to understand Jesus is the Son of God. His identity as Son is so important because it means that everything he is entitled to as God's Son is now ours. It means that his innocence, his life, his honor, his adoption, his glory, it's yours as you approach God's presence. It's also significant who it is that finally recognizes this. Who is it declaring Jesus is the Son of God? It's a murderer. It's a Roman centurion. It is the enemy of God brought into relationship, a confession of faith from the very man who just hung Jesus on the cross. If you feel like you're too sinful for God to ever accept you, if you feel like what you've done disqualifies you from ever becoming a Christian, look to this. If a Roman centurion can profess faith, if Simon of Cyrene, a Gentile, is made a friend of Jesus at the start of this account, most importantly, if the Son of God was rejected as your substitute, then no sin is too great for God to welcome you in. Sinner, will this not suffice? Come to God in the shadow of the cross. Others of you, you know that you're accepted into God's presence, but who cares? I mean, when the boots hit the ground, why does this even matter? I've already told you it affects your relationships significantly, but think about how this affects your prayers. Your prayers are heard by someone in your very presence who accepts you, who welcomes you in. He welcomes your prayers. And not only that, he speaks back to you through his word, the Father giving wisdom to his child. Think about how it affects your worship. When you worship God through song and through good deeds, you are like a priest entering God's presence with incense. He loves it. He accepts your worship in his presence. In other words, God's presence is experienced in all these ordinary aspects of the Christian life, through reading your Bible, through prayer, through worship and song and in good deeds in your community in the church. These are all the ordinary, basic aspects of the Christian life. So my encouragement for you is experience God's presence in them. Keep doing them. Don't stop running this race. Keep living the Christian life. This is how you experience God. Ultimately, being accepted in God's presence means that one day when you die, your existence doesn't just fade into darkness. For some of you, death is a very present fear. This is on the forefront of your mind. But what this passage shows us is that when you breathe your last, when you close your eyes for the last time, your heart stops beating, you die. When that happens, you open your eyes and you look upon your glorious God for the first time and you are welcomed in his presence. Death is not the end. You experience his embrace, his glory, his love. You are the beloved son to Abba, Father. You experience that fully when you pass from this earth and into the next. Your shame is gone. Your life begins. Your acceptance is sure. All this because the Son of God uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. Father, thank you for the gospel of Jesus Christ. Thank you that the Son of God died in our place, that we become your children through the death of Christ. Thank you that he stood before the wrath of God, shielding sinners with his blood. Thank you that you accept us despite our shame, despite the horrible things that we have done. That's not who we are. We are honorable because of the death of Christ. God, let us have faith in this. Let this transform the way we live. Let this breathe new life into our pursuit of you. Let this transform our relationships. Let us be a people who loves each other, bears with one another, offers grace and forgiveness freely, because that's who we are.